Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Robert Baer, who was the CIA operations officer in charge of the north of Iraq in the Kurdish area during the interregnum between the two wars against Iraq starting in 91 through to the recent war. And he has more than anybody access and experience with Iraqi exiles, and we're looking into following up from last week where Vincent Canestrero, former senior CIA officer, former head of counterterrorism at the CIA and director of national intelligence at the director of intelligence of the National Security Council under President Reagan, suggested that the Niger documents were forged here in the United States. We were talking about curveball, so we'll be doing a follow-up on how much the justification for the United States to go to war was based upon phony and fabricated intelligence. We'll be talking with Robert Baer in a moment. We'll also talk with Charles Kupchan, who's a former head of the European desk at the National Security Council under President Clinton. He's now a professor of political science at Georgetown University. We'll be talking to him about the confirmation this week in the Senate, the hearings on the confirmation of John Bolton to be the United States representative to the United Nations. There's an expectation that the Democrats may be able to stall this this nominee if they can peel off one Republican, particularly the wavering senator from Rhode Island. So we'll be talking about that. And then we'll talk with Julia Preston, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. She, in 1998, she won the Pulitzer Prize for her coverage of Mexico's narcotics underworld. She, along with her husband Sam Dillon, were the New York Times Mexico bureau chiefs from 1995 to 2000, and we'll be talking to her. She's also written about Mexico's nascent democracy, opening Mexico, the making of a democracy. We'll be talking to Julia about the two issues this week. One, the Minutemen on the border of Mexico, talk about border issues, and also the outrageous impeachment of the mayor of Mexico City, López Obrador, who is expected to be the PRD, the leftist party's candidate for president. He's been stripped of his parliamentary immunity and railroaded over a minor legal infraction, obviously a pretext to get him out of the race. So we'll be talking about Mexico's steps backwards from democracy in the last segment. I'm now speaking with Robert Baer, who was CIA's operations officer in the Kurdish North between the two Gulf Wars. He wrote a book about that experience called See No Evil, which has been made into a movie where George Clooney plays you, Bob. And you also wrote more recently, Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. Obviously, I spoke with Vincent Canestrero last week about the curveball story, which came out of the Rob Silverman Presidential Commission into the failures of intelligence vis-a-vis weapons of mass destruction in the prelude to the Iraq War. There's clearly a lot of phony intelligence evidence has appeared, both through curveball, through the Niger documents, and through other venues. You know the Iraqi exiles better than anything. How much were they all we had? And clearly we got played, right?
They weren't all we had. I mean, we never through the 90s considered them to be reliable sources. We knew they had a dog in the fight. We knew they were lying to us. And if you pressed them, they would tell you that they were lying to us. Chalabi, in particular, was never trusted. He never had verifiable intelligence, reliable intelligence. In fact, he would identify units in Iraq that he supposedly was in touch with, and we'd look on satellite photography, and they weren't where they said they were supposed to be. The same way with Iyad Alawi, the current prime minister of Iraq, completely unreliable. The big question is, how did this information get into a national intelligence estimate in October 2002, and why did anybody believe it, especially Dick Cheney, the vice president, who had no confidence either in the CIA's information or the exiles' information? I can only think it was systematic and willful you know, selling this stuff to the American people.
But why, given that we already had one war against Saddam Hussein, why wasn't it an imperative to get information on Iraq?
It was difficult to get, first of all. I was assigned to northern Iraq. I was assigned there to collect intelligence. Saddam ran the government in a very small circle, mainly his two sons. Getting to them was very difficult. We had no station in Baghdad at the time. The European intelligence services were worse off than we were. It was a black hole. And, of course, that's the whole point, is that national intelligence estimate of 2002 in October should have said Iraq's a black hole. It may have weapons of mass destruction. It may not.
And what about there was a rival group to Chalabi's group that were former military officers, and I understand that the Chalabi actually dropped a dime on them. So were there competing sources? And it seems like we were relying on the least reliable.
They were equally unreliable. The military officers, again, none of their information checked out with what we knew from signals intelligence, from satellite photography. And again, I say the point is we didn't trust them. And in the body of knowledge inside the Directorate of Operations, inside the CIA, everybody knew that. The question is, why did George Tenet and John McLaughlin, his deputy, override what we knew to be true and not to be true?
But we also know that there was a competing intelligence shop at the Pentagon, and they not only relied on Chalabi, but they tried to promote him as the next leader.
Well, they took him over because once the CIA determined that Chalabi was a fabricator, it dropped him. It said, we're not even going to meet the guy. It's not worth our time. It's not worth the paper writing up his stuff. That's when the Pentagon picked him up. Doug Feith, in particular, Office of Special Plans. And what this is known with is in the neocon circles is competitive intelligence. If you don't like the answer you're getting out of the CIA, go somewhere else. You know, presumably, if you didn't get the answer you liked out of the Pentagon, you just go to the Internet and look up conspiracy theories and use that as intelligence to justify a war.
Well, it's extraordinary that it's still going on. There was a piece in the Los Angeles Times this week, an opinion piece by Max Boot, suggesting that Curveball and the Rob Silverman Commission, in fact, exonerated Chalabi, even though it turns out that Curveball is the brother of Chalabi's top aide.
It's silly to exonerate him because there were a lot of other reporting that went on from Chalabi. Not involved with Curveball, that would suggest that he kept his weapons of mass destruction. He used to give me this stuff when I was in northern Iraq and met him. It was equally unreliable then.
Well, there's also, last week, Vincent Canestraro mentioned the Niger documents, which were the documents, supposedly Iraqi documents trying to purchase uranium from Niger. The CIA ended up sending Ambassador Wilson over there because he'd served in Niger to check these out. He came back. Then, for some reason or other, these claims ended up in Bush's State of the Union address, where he said that Saddam was trying to purchase significant quantities of uranium from Niger. He attributed that to the British. We understood, and then in retaliation, I mean, then Wilson, Ambassador Wilson, wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times saying, look, you know, I don't know how that got in the President's State of the Union address, because we refuted those claims, and I went over there specifically to find out about them. In retaliation to Wilson's contradicting the President, the White House, or at least the Vice President's office, it's assumed, leaked identity of Wilson's wife, who's an operations officer in the CIA, and now there's a special prosecutor looking into it. That's essentially stalled, because instead of sweating the people inside the Vice President's office who are guilty of leaking, they're sweating a couple of reporters, one of whom didn't even write the story. So that has been stalled, but what Vince Canestraro mentioned last week, which is key and revives this story, is that the Niger documents themselves were manufactured over here. So what do you know about that? Because I've been sort of looking into it.
I've seen a transcript from his interview, Vince Canestrero's, and the rumor is certainly out there that the neocons were behind this forgery, but no one's produced any evidence that I've ever seen that would suggest that that's true or not.
Well, 60 Minutes apparently has the evidence.
I know the producer, and I know they had that story, and I know after the Dan Rather fiasco, they pulled the story, CBS did, at the corporate level, even though it was a good story. I don't know what they have at this point. But this is not being pursued. The FBI is supposedly looking into it. And again, I go back to the question, the UN identified the Niger documents as forgers immediately.
Right.
It was within 15 minutes of looking at them that it was unanimous they were forgeries. I didn't need to see the documents to know that the Iraqis don't send the Minister of Information to Niger to buy uranium. That's not the way their procurement system ever worked. It was very well known how they were doing this, who was doing it, and you don't send somebody unreliable for a sensitive task like this. So it was on the face of it, it was implausible, wherever these things were forged.
Yeah, but they ended up in the State of the Union address and being used as justification for this war. So they're very significant, and they clearly were forgeries from day one. And you would think that the 900-pound gorilla would be who forged them.
Who forged them, or why didn't the Robb Commission look into how this stuff got into the State of the Union? Why was that never addressed, which was these clear forgeries at that point? And we go back to the other lie about this benign lie that the neocons are putting out about the meeting between Atta, the presumed leader of 9/11, and the Iraqi intelligence officer.
That's the alleged meeting in Prague, right?
There's a majority of Americans that still believe that occurred, that Saddam, last polls I've seen, was involved in 9/11. And, of course, that's another blatant fabrication. Because we had pictures of Atta in Florida, the FBI does, completely refuted that. But right up until the war, the administration was putting out this propaganda to justify going into Iraq.
But, Robert Baird, it is not uncommon for documents and news stories, for that matter, to be planted into the foreign press or foreign intelligence agencies and fed back to the United States, right?
It happens all the time. It's not supposed to happen with the CIA. If you put in disinformation in the foreign press, the objective shouldn't be to get back to the United States. But, of course, if you're outsourcing intelligence, which is apparently what happened with the Iraqi National Congress and Chalabi and the Niger documents, you completely bypass U.S. law. It's like outsourcing torture.
And we didn't, I mean, obviously 60 Minutes has a lot of evidence, and obviously for obvious reasons they don't want to talk to me because, you know, they've invested in this. I talked to their main source who also didn't want to be interviewed. He's a former Defense Intelligence Agency senior officer. So what we do know is that the documents came through CISME, the Italian intelligence service, and ended up, I think, Panorama, the Berlusconi's group, first got them, and then they ended up back here. There was also a break-in in the Niger embassy in Rome at the same time, was there not?
There was a break-in, which, in a sense, if you're doing covert action, that makes the story plausible. If there was organized inside of an intelligence service, I would have hoped the documents would have been better. They were so obviously forgeries that it looks like this was done by somebody extremely inexperienced or had never done this before.
So this is nothing that the professional Israeli intelligence people would be behind. This would be an off-the-books operation.
I hope they're better than that, but of course they're going downhill like the CIA.
Right. So, again, what do we make of this, the reason why this key information somehow can't get out when it's so clear that this thing stinks to high heaven? What do you think the resistance is? Are the White House that good that they've got everybody intimidated?
I think the press is intimidated to take this on, not demand an investigation of the Niger documents. The way it works in the FBI, if you don't want to get to the bottom of a story, you assign your worst team to investigate it. You follow a couple leads. You fly out to Rome. You talk to the journalist involved from Panorama, who claims not to know anything. You talk to CISME. You can't come to a conclusion, and you close the investigation. And there's, you know, the strange thing is there's no demand from the Senate for a thorough investigation, a forensic investigation by the CIA and everybody else, how this happened. It seems to be everybody's just sort of forgotten it. That's what disturbs me, because they were misled into a war.
Well, you'd think that the entire public would be up in arms, and particularly, you know, families of the military that are over there. They're over there on false pretenses, you know. We've all been had. I mean, it's pretty obvious.
The only person I've seen come out and, see, and you know, defend the CIA is Jim Pavitt, the director of operations, and Tyler Drumheller, the chief of the European division, which is a start, I guess. These guys have just come out and said, listen, the curveball story was pushed politically. They've said that, essentially, and the George Tenet refused to put an end to it, at least to get it out of Powell's speech. So what you see is the leadership of the CIA providing talking points for the White House, which had decided to go to war. Additionally, there's emails with inside the CIA that have gotten out that officers saying, who cares whether the intelligence is good or not? The administration's going to war.
Well, it's extraordinary, though, that again, if you go back to 60 Minutes of sitting on a story, that apparently they did do some of the legwork that you were mentioning that the FBI would normally do, talk to CISME, they talk to the oversight people in the Italian parliament as well. So apparently there is some evidence trail there. Leading to Michael Ledeen, and yet...
Well, I think 60 Minutes is afraid if they make one small... I've dealt with 60 Minutes before. If they make a small error, they'll get pounded on, even though the story is 99% right. And in a story like this, you're bound to make an error, but what they're afraid is that they're going to be further discredited, then any chance of doing objective reporting will be finished after the Rather report. Well, the problem, of course, at the end of the day is the American people... The ones that are conscious of what's going on are lose confidence in legitimacy of their government. And that's the sad thing, because what if we are faced with a nuclear threat from Iran? I wouldn't trust anything anybody said about whether they have weapons or not at this point after Iraq. And maybe they do, and you know, but who can trust the CIA now?
Well, just in closing, Robert Baird, do you think, you know, and I mentioned this to in the interview I did last week with Vince Canestrano, that a part of the problem seems to be, and you were trying to develop intelligence between the two wars from the Kurdish north out of the Iraqis, and you said they were all useless and unreliable. But, you know, going, in fact, ironically, it was Joe Wilson who was the last who closed the door on the embassy there back in 1990. And we haven't had anybody on the ground. We don't have any representation in Iran. We don't have any representation in North Korea. Don't you think it would be worth it to recognize these countries just to get people in there?
Well, you should always recognize and talk to your enemy. More than anybody, you need to talk to your enemy, not your friends, in diplomacy. And that's a huge mistake not to engage these people. But more than that, I say that if you don't have intelligence on a country, this has to be put on the record. It's not when you sit down and you rely on fabricators like Chalabi.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Robert Baird, who was the CIA's operations officer in the north of Iraq, in the Kurdish area, between the two wars, working with Chalabi and all the other intelligence sources who this administration relied upon to, and along with phony documents, to go to war. I'm now speaking with Charles Kupchan, who's the former head of the European desk at the National Security Council under President Clinton. He's now a professor of political science at Georgetown University. And there's an expectation this week in the Senate, Charles Kupchan, that there'll be a real Donnybrook and that the Democrats may finally, you know, show some spine and backbone, given that they'd be getting a lot of criticism, mostly from Democrats themselves. But there's also an expectation that perhaps they'll be able to block John Bolton's nomination by peeling off the wavering senator from Rhode Island. Do you have any special insight in terms of handicapping this event?
Well, it's hard to predict because it really does come down to Chafee's willingness to stand against the nomination, and he is probably going through some tough calculations right now. about the costs of defecting from the Republican Party versus the costs of alienating mostly a Democratic population of Rhode Island. But I do think that the debate that's taking place over Bolton is a positive one in the sense that it does indicate that the public discourse is waking up again after Bush's victory. It went into the dark radio silence, as it did, I think, during the first couple of years of the Bush administration. The Democrats are trying to organize themselves on this. Steve Clemens and some other bloggers are making this a cause célèbre. So I think the hearings that begin tomorrow morning will be interesting. And in some ways, we're seeing a bit of a national referendum on Bush's first term and his unilateralism. It seems to have gotten a thumbs up in the election last November, but here's another try.
So does it come down to the fact that what the Democrats are saying that this guy is essentially the poster boy for Bush's foreign policy, and it's done nothing but alienate our friends and allies and embolden and empower our enemies? That's essentially their argument. And I guess on the Bush side, they're saying, no, we need a guy that's like this, because you got to put America first. And essentially, I guess the weakness in the Democratic argument is that probably most people in this country think it's okay to tell the rest of the world to go to hell, right? I mean,
yeah, I think it's a very complicated issue, because if you look at public opinion surveys on multilateralism versus unilateralism and on whether Americans support the UN, the answer across the board is yes. But when it comes to how important an issue is this for most Americans, then the answers drop way down, way below everything else. So Americans are multilateralists, but they're not willing to do much about it. On the other hand, those people who oppose the UN and who are unilateralists become very politically active. They organize. They talk about the black helicopters of the UN and the Multilateral Commission. You can win votes in this country by calling the UN the Frankenstein that we must slay. You will not get elected in this country by running on a platform calling for U.S. troops under a UN command. And that's I think, unfortunate, but that's where we are. In terms of Bolton himself, I think there are four separate and quite distinct arguments about why he's not a good choice for the UN. One is that he's a principled unilateralist. He has made a career of opposing international institutions. He, for example, was a front runner in the battle against the ICC, the International Criminal Court, during the Clinton administration and also once Bush was in office. We've seen just in the last few weeks the cost of that, months of delay over how to bring to justice the war criminals in Darfur. And the second would be the symbolic issue that here's President Bush trying to reach out to the world, as you put it, and who's he choosing to do so in the UN? Someone that is about as little appreciated abroad as anyone, because he is so outspoken.
So this is a sort of Dracula in charge of the blood bank syndrome.
Yeah, I mean, it says, the UN is the one forum that the rest of the world looks to as a place to do business on a more democratic basis, and Bush nominates someone who is openly dismissive of the UN. What kind of message does that send? The third problem is that he's a very combative and divisive guy. He is not diplomatic, if you will, and I think some Bush people say that's good because the UN needs straight talk, but it's not good in the sense that the person at the UN needs to build coalitions and consensus in the back room. And the final issue that I think will come up this week is whether he played some funny business while in office, dismissing people who disagreed with him, asked for certain types of intelligence assessments, and when he didn't get them, suppressed dissent.
That's specifically when he came up with the notion that the Cubans had a sophisticated biological warfare program. And nobody in the intelligence community would support that. And some analyst apparently got fired for opposing him, right?
Yeah, I can't speak to the veracity of those claims. I've simply seen the same reports that you have. But there are individuals who will be testifying this week who will state that he did dismiss them in an inappropriate fashion and to the service of manipulating intelligence and suppressing dissent. Don't know whether that's true or not, but it will be up to the committee to come to its own conclusions.
Well, of course, I don't know what this plays in the overall picture here, but recall Florida 2000, where the presidential vote hung in the balance for a long time, and essentially the Democrats got outlawed in Florida, mm-hmm. and the Republicans won, or the Bush won by 537 votes. At one key point in that, the counting was shut down in Miami-Dade County by what's been referred to as the Gucci Rebellion, where a bunch of Republican activists stormed the courthouse where they were counting their votes and intimidated the people into stopping the count. That particular revolt, if you will, was led by none other than John Bolton.
Well,
so maybe he's getting that's the source of his the president's loyalty to him. You know that.
Yeah. Listen, he is a very tenacious guy, and
he has a bronzed hand grenade on his desk. You know.
Yeah. I've debated him on some talk shows over the years, and I can tell you that this guy doesn't take prisoners, and that is, I think, part of the reason the Bush team wants him at the UN, and part of the reason that the opposition to him is so vociferous. John Bolton is not the type of person to which one feels dispassionate. He's the kind of guy that provokes sharp sentiments on one side of the ledger or the other.
Well, you know, his mentor, Senator Jesse Helms, once said of Bolton, described Bolton as the kind of man I would want to stand with at Armageddon. Given that there's the best-selling book in this country, 60 million copies have been sold of the End of Times, you know, and maybe it's it can't be sort of dismissed so lightly, this phenomenon of this sort of vast death wish that's going on out there. But
yeah, and it's, you know, it's a very complicated ideological landscape right now, because there's a lot of talk about the neocons, and I don't put Bolton into that category. He is someone who really harks back to the 19th century, a classic heartland populist unilateralist.
Is he an isolationist, do you think? I mean, because this is the strange mixture in the Bush administration and its support in the heartland, is this kind of almost contradictory combination of unilateralism and isolationism.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Ian. And one often sees these terms portrayed as polar opposites, but they're not. They're flip sides of the same coin. Because if you go back to the founding fathers, they talked both about this isolationism that should be a function of our natural security, but also a libertarianism and an American exceptionalism that was about, you know, we Americans don't really want to engage in the world, but if we have to, then we'll do it as we see fit. And we will do it with a hard sovereignty around us. And that's what sunk the League of Nations when Wilson took it to the Senate in 1919 and 1920. And it's exactly the ideological tradition that John Bolton has tapped into, and I think it Bush in many respects has used to his electoral benefit throughout the red states.
Well, I guess it goes back to George Washington's admonition to avoid foreign entanglements, but to trade with everybody, but to make alliances with nobody.
Right. And, you know, if I were to recommend one thing that Americans should read to get a sense of what's going on in Washington over Bolton, it would be the debate in the Senate in 1919 about ratification of the League of Nations, because it was all about this fundamental question of of international organizations, and will they ultimately encroach on American sovereignty? And it is that principled opposition to international organizations that Bolton represents, and one of the main reasons that his opponents feel he's so inappropriate for the UN.
Well, Charles Cupton, you were the head of the European desk at the National Security Council under President Clinton, and obviously dealt extensively with the Europeans. What's your reading on them? Because they were both aghast at Bolton's nomination and at Paul Wolfowitz's nomination for the World Bank, which apparently they've swallowed that one.
Yeah, and I think you have to see Europe's strategy at this point as one of, listen, Bush has been reelected. We got to live with this team for four more years. We got to do business with them. I think that's why they ultimately agreed to let Wolfowitz be appointed as the president of the World Bank. The Wolfowitz appointment, I think, is a more complicated one because he is someone who I think has a career that would lend itself to serving as the World Bank head, but because of his role in the Iraq War, I think many people question whether this is a person that should be rewarded by becoming the head of a major international institution. But the Europeans, especially since the trip that Bush made a couple of months ago, where he generally came with flowers in hand, have decided to hold their fire for now. And there has been some payoff. I mean, Bush has agreed to work with Europe on a negotiating strategy with Iran, and he is, I think, backing away from some of the more hardline positions that he took throughout the first term.
Well, just to touch a little bit, if I may, on the earlier subject we're talking about the lead up to the war and the amount of phony documentation that's out there. Both we just had the curveball, well, not curveball hearings, but the Rob Silverman Commission,
yeah,
where curveball featured in much of the coverage of that, and now questions about the Niger documents being forged here in the United States.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, just in, we're talking a little bit of history here, going back to George Washington and the League of Nations. You know, in terms of history, I guess it's, this would be on the equivalent of the Zimmerman telegram that helped to get America into World War One, or the Bay of Tonkin resolutions, or perhaps blowing up the Maine in Havana Harbor. I know there's a history of this, but this does seem to be a pretty serious matter, isn't it? Do you get the feeling that anything is, I mean, I know they're going to debate Bolton, but there are bigger issues out there that seem to be in, you know, being ignored, perhaps, you know.
I agree with you that these are very important issues, and one report after another has come out and said that American intelligence was dead wrong. And the WMD search team in Iraq has shut its doors and concluded no WMD, which was the main rationale for America's invasion. Unfortunately, I think that this issue is almost over from the perspective of political traction, that Americans have made up their mind one way or the other about the war, and that a new report about where the Niger uranium story came from, or a new report about this piece of evidence or that piece of evidence, could mean the end of someone's career. But there seems to be a certain almost suspension of inquiry on these issues. And unfortunately, because I think it's unjustified, I think Bush has paid as much of a price for the intelligence failure as he will, and the inquiries will move forward. But I think in terms of many Americans' minds, this is a case closed.
Well, but the president and his people have been very clever at basically turning their mistakes and lapses of judgment and indifference to minding the store and being at the helm of the ship of state. And in effect, what they've done is you know, it's like having a car accident. You blame the car, not the driver. They managed to going back to the Richard Clark inquiries at the 9/11 Commission. They managed to say that it wasn't their fault. It was the fault of the intelligence services. But if you're saying that the American people basically if they were told that the justification for getting into this war was created by phony documents that were cooked up by the very same people who sold us this war, that's new. I didn't, even in history, I don't think you've got anything quite that brazen where the war party cooks up its own justification for war and then takes the nation to war.
Right.
And it seems that we're all in suspense here because not only are the press not interested in looking into the provenance of how we got there, they don't seem to be even interested in the war itself. The president's managed to tell everybody that things are going fine, and the press are echoing that. As far as I know, there's a completely different reality in Iraq that is not at all rosy.
I agree completely, and I didn't mean to suggest that should it be the case that these documents were cooked up by Americans and then sent back into the intelligence cycle, that that's not a very, very serious manipulation of the American political process. I do worry, however, that the public and the media have to some extent checked out of this story. I remember watching primetime CNN coverage when the WMD, Weapons of Mass Destruction team, announced that it was closing its doors and ending inquiry. This didn't appear until 30 minutes into CNN primetime broadcast. And that gives you some sense about where the media sees this issue now. Why is that the case? I think partly for the reasons that you spelled out. The Bush administration is very, very good at what it does when it comes to message creation. For example, giving the Medal of Honor to George Tenet and to the commanders of the war was in some ways a way of communicating to the American public that this was a great patriotic enterprise. Well, was it? Perhaps some of us think it's a fiasco. But they're very good at framing the policy debates in ways that I think inure them against some of the accusations of failure on the intelligence front.
So at what point does reality bite?
Well, you know, I think that reality bites when bad things happen. And the Iraq war strikes me as a very bad thing. But number one, as you said, we are being told that it's going well, and there isn't a lot of pushback on that front. We're not paying for the war because the costs are being put on a great big national credit card. Indeed, our taxes are being cut. We don't have conscription in this country, and therefore very few families have children in Iraq. And to some extent, we are therefore buffered from the war. And I think that's one of the main reasons that the American public has not reacted to it in a harsher and more negative way.
Well, perhaps there'll be some questions of John Bolton in this regard, do you think, in this coming week? I mean, it's the subtext is the Bush foreign policy, isn't it?
My guess is that the Iraq war will figure in the debate in the Senate committee. But I also think that there will be a lot of careful parsing over his general positions about international institutions, his statements about the UN, his opposition to the International Criminal Court, and because I think the Democrats could make a quite effective case that here is a guy who is a dyed-in-the-wool unilateralist who thinks that international institutions are not just a waste of time, but dangerous.
Yeah, but isn't the reality in Iraq is that the Bush people want to declare victory and get out and put up any kind of patina of success that they can. And at the end of the day, aren't they going to need the UN?
Well, you know, they've already got the UN back in to some extent. But I think the answer to that is to some extent no, because the UN is barely on the ground. Even our stalwart allies, like the Italians, have announced that they're going to start pulling troops out. And so I think the name of the game from here through the end of this year and early into next will be to train the Iraqi forces.
All of which are Kurd and Shia. Almost 90% of them are Kurd.
Almost exclusively.
Exclusively, right.
And, you know, call it what you will, we're going to hand over as much power as we can and head to the exits. And frankly, I think that's the right thing to do. because I was opposed to this war from the get-go. I don't think that we're going to end up with a democratic and stable Iraq, but I think the best thing to do is get a functioning government and a functioning army and reduce the continuing costs on America.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Charles Kupchan.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. So just speaking there with Charles Kupchan, who's a former head of the European desk at the National Security Council under President Clinton. He's now a professor of political science at Georgetown University. I'm now speaking with Julia Preston, who along with Sam Dillon were the New York Times' Mexico bureau chiefs from 1995 to 2000. Along with two other reporters, they won a Pulitzer Prize in 1998 for their coverage of Mexico's narcotics underworld, and their new book, Opening Mexico, The Making of a Democracy, is now in paperback. And Julia, The Making of Democracy, which you've covered in your book, seems to be in large part being unmade in the last week in Mexico City, where the Chamber of Deputies, the Mexican Congress, voted to strip Andres Manuel López Obrador, the mayor of Mexico City's, from immunity, therefore exposing him to what looks like an extremely trumped up minor charge, which will then disqualify him from running as the PRD's candidate in the upcoming presidential election. I guess chutzpah, brazen, what words come to mind?
Well, Ian, I think there's no question that this is a major setback and crisis for Mexican democracy. One of the problems here is that this has been framed as by the Fox administration, by President Fox, and also by the pre-deputies, that is to say the deputies from the old system that ruled Mexico for so many years. This has been framed as a move to defend legality. But what it really does is reveal the inadequacies in the Mexican justice system, not only in police enforcement and corruption and that sort of thing, but also in the nature of the legal code itself. This is a case where a very prominent and successful politician has been held accountable personally for what is a minor civil dispute by an action by his government. And so you could imagine if Mike Bloomberg, for example, who's the mayor of New York City, was held personally responsible for all the screw-ups by his by the borough chief in the Bronx, which is would be a comparable situation. I mean, Bloomberg would never get out of jail. So this is the origin of this problem has to do with the fact that Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the Mexico City mayor, has been held personally responsible for something that he shouldn't be held for. And one of the things I want to point out about this, just to clarify things for your listeners, is that he's not being charged with corruption. This is not a corruption charge against the mayor. This is a civil dispute minor nature.
But it's a device to get him off the ticket, isn't it?
I think that he makes quite a plausible case to say that that is true. There is, in fact, a court order against him. There is a prosecutor who is willing to prosecute, and a judge who has issued the order. So it's not entirely illegal or extra-legal, this proceeding, but it has its origin, and the fact that it's come this far is, I think, entirely political.
And do you think that that throughout the Mexican populace that this just reinforces a kind of despair that's already there, that there isn't any rule of law? I mean, there was an expectation getting rid of the PRI and bringing the PAN in that there would be a sea change in Mexico. So what's your reading on almost at an emotional level, how is this playing out?
Well, I think that this mayor has become a very popular and prominent politician because he did the something highly unexpected, which is he was a successful mayor of Mexico City, which many people thought was an impossible task. And so certainly his followers in the city and people who have come to support him because of his actions in government, his measures that have garnered support, I think they can only be very discouraged by this. The polls show and have shown for at least a year now that Andrés Manuel López Obrador is by far the most recognized and popular politician in Mexico. If there were a presidential election today, I think he would clearly win it. And so what's very, I think, disheartening to many Mexicans about this is that this legal maneuver has been used to deprive them of the opportunity to vote for this man in the upcoming presidential election, which is in 2006. But it's also deprived them of, and deprived him of the possibility and also potentially the requirement to campaign. Somewhat ironically, this mayor does have some corruption issues to answer for. And one of the discouraging things about what happened in this case with this vote to strip him of immunity is that he won't be facing justice or won't be facing the voters, apparently, on those issues. Those issues will have been sort of pushed to the background because of this action by the Congress.
Now, but how much, Julia Preston, though, is this a repeat of previous history where, remember, when Salinas was elected, Cárdenas, the PRD candidate, clearly won. There was massive fraud, and it was so flagrant that they even burned all the ballots.
Yes, although I would actually dispute that your assertion that Cárdenas clearly won. I don't think it was ever clear that Cárdenas won that election, and we went through that in quite a good deal of detail in the book. But, of course, we'll never know because, as you point out, Carlos Salinas maneuvered to have the ballots burned, and so the actual answer to that question is lost to history.
At least it justifies suspicion, doesn't it?
I mean, that the election was fraudulent of 1988, it was clearly fraudulent election. But I would go to different history, Ian, which is to look at the history, the political biography of Andrés Manuel López Obrador. And I think that is actually gives us some hope that this apparent train wreck will be worked out by the same means that it was created, which is by political maneuvering and negotiation. Because this is not by any means the first time that this man has faced this kind of adversity. He ran, for example, for governor of his home state, which is Tabasco, in 1994 against a man named Roberto Madrazo from the ruling system. I would say parenthetically that Roberto Madrazo may be the man that the PRI will offer as its candidate in the next presidential election in 2006. So in 1994, Andrés Manuel ran against Madrazo, and a subsequent investigation, which was based on extraordinary documentary evidence, original documents from the PRI, showed that Madrazo had spent more than $30 million to buy votes and advertising and purchase that election. There was an investigation by the Attorney General of Mexico. It proved that it showed really quite clearly that there had been electoral fraud in that election, and Madrazo managed to walk away from it. But Andrés Manuel López Obrador launched a campaign of protest, which brought him on several marches to Mexico City and essentially sealed his passage from state electoral politics to become a national figure. And so this is a man who is not only daunted by this kind of adversity, but seems to really thrive in it.
Well, what about the notion that there are, I mean, I don't think there's any question about that, there are powerful interests, particularly business interests in Mexico, that simply don't want the PRD, the party that López Obrador belongs to get into power. It was also the party that Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas represented. They have actually had an electoral success in Guerrero, which was a cacique-run, very corrupt PRI state forever, run by the Figueroa family. Address that broader issue of what interests are afraid of Mexico electing a left-wing a party to the presidency.
Well, I think they're probably very substantial, but I wonder whether those interests, you know, the large capitalist interests, would in the long run think that it was they were better served by having national turmoil than by moving back towards an orderly election, even with the risk that Andrés Manuel López Obrador might win it. We haven't really had a chance to see a lot about how he might perform on a national stage. We have a couple of examples, though, from Mexico City. For example, one of the things he did in Mexico City was make an alliance with a man named Carlos Slim, who is not only the wealthiest man in Mexico, but he's the fourth wealthiest man in the world. This is the chairman of the board of Telmex, and the telecommunications magnate, and he made an alliance to renovate downtown Mexico City that was quite successful. And so I think there's obviously a powerful opposition to, especially in the Fox camp, the conservative PAN camp, but whether they are willing to tolerate a year of protests and turmoil, it really remains to be seen.
Well, there's an editorial in today's Sunday's Los Angeles Times about Mexico's impeachment of López Obrador. It also says that in the article that Obrador has a penchant for incendiary demagoguery that seems to echo the likes of Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. So there are people in this country who don't want another Chavez, you know.
Well, perhaps that's right, but I think that the process of this impeachment or this stripping of his immunity has served quite unfortunately to push Andrés Manuel to the left and bring out some of that demagogic politics that he is known for. But in a sense, you can hardly blame the man. He is being prosecuted and stripped of his political rights for an issue that is really quite a minor issue. And it's just a shame that what had been, in spite of a lot of adversity, quite an orderly democratic process has been interrupted in this fashion.
Well, wouldn't you agree, though, Julia, that if the PRI comes back, that will be a major setback for Mexican democracy?
I think I would not agree with that, actually, because I think, well, first of all, we need to see.
But think about all the baggage that the PRI has.
Yes, but I think we need to see, first of all, who their candidate is going to be. And to prejudge this election before we really know who the candidates are going to be, I think is a mistake. But the other...
Well, remember, there was a good candidate that they offered up after Salinas, and he was assassinated by his own party, from what we can follow, from the so-called dinosaurs, perhaps Echeverria.
Well, I think the point is that the nature of politics in Mexico today precludes the possibility that the PRI could come back as a dictatorial, authoritarian, corrupt, and oppressive government that it was for 71 years in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
For better or worse, what you have today is a very contentious multi-party system as of this week, locked in quite a bit of turmoil. But the possibility of the kind of velvet dictatorship that existed for Mexico in Mexico for so many years is no longer there.
Well, just in the last minute, I'm sorry we run out of time, but I wanted to touch on the border issues this week, given that the Minutemen were down there on the Arizona border.
Yeah.
Clearly, this is, you know, if you've ever watched Lou Dobbs on CNN, he's pounding this story relentlessly. What do you think's going on here? Is there any resolution? Because it seems to me that the border issues with the southern border are essentially paralyzed by the laissez-faire right, who wants cheap labor, and the politically correct left, who doesn't want to deal with reality. So, what's going to happen?
It's crystal clear that the United States has an immigration policy that is not working. We have a huge movement of migrants back and forth across this border in response to real labor market conditions that exist in the United States. And we have consistently refused or declined to make available legal channels of immigration to those workers. And until we do that, we're just going to have this kind of very dangerous situation where people in the border area think they can take the law into their own hands.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Julia Preston, and for your book, The Opening Mexico, The Making of a Democracy.
It's a pleasure to speak with you, Ian.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Julia Preston, who, along with Osman Sam Dillon, were the New York Times bureau chiefs in Mexico City from 1995 to 2000, and they won a Pulitzer Prize in 1998 for their coverage of Mexico's narcotics underworld. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the engineer, Mark Maxwell, and assistant producers, Carol Coote and Rusty Wynn.